When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
London-based Thirst, the International Roundtable for Sustainable Tea, a non-profit human rights initiative, launched a three-year human rights impact assessment study in 2022. The study aims to listen and understand the human rights concerns in the tea sector and bring stakeholders together to seek solutions. We've been following Thirst's study from the start, and now with phase two complete, we caught up with CEO and founder Shobhita Banerjee to hear about the findings and next steps. Shobhita is an economic and social justice consultant, campaigner, writer, activist with over two decades in international development and trade justice. Thank you, Shobhita, for joining us at TBiz. I've been glad to keep up with the study by Thirst and to keep up with what you've been doing. So really looking forward to hearing what you have to share with us today on phase two.
Thank you for having me on.
I was reading the report that you've already published on the Thirst site, and I think there's a lot of things there that our current preoccupations with the industry folks. But before we go into that, if you can just once again introduce the study that you planned, what phase one was and phase two was, that would be good for our listeners.
Thanks, Arvinda. Yes, so the report is the second one in our three-year human rights impact assessment of the global tea industry. It's quite a unique study in the sense that it's an independent human rights impact assessment. It hasn't been commissioned by any company, although we have had contributions towards it from various companies and organisations. And so that's one unique thing about it. It's also, we're doing it over 3 years, which I think is quite unusual for a human rights impact assessment. And the fact that it also that it's at an industry level is quite unusual. Human rights impact assessments are usually done by one company of one of their supply chains to one country. Whereas we're not looking at every single one of the 60 countries where tea is grown and every one of the thousands of companies involved, but we're looking at how the industry itself operates. Because we believe that there are probably a lot of answers from that perspective about how the human rights of tea workers and farmers may be impacted. The last thing that's quite unique about the study is that we're not intending to present the tea industry with a list of recommendations, but we are pulling together as much information as possible that will help them with other stakeholders to sit down and come up with the recommendations themselves. We're hoping that we'll be able to get them together with NGOs, with trade unions, with different stakeholders and actors throughout the tea value chain to work out solutions to the problems that we've highlighted using the analysis that we've done on the root causes of those breaches. And it's then for them to come up with solutions that will be realistic, but also because the trade unions and NGOs would be involved as well, that would also, you know, sufficiently meet the needs of the tea workers and farmers. So in year one, just 2022, we published a literature review which outlined how the tea industry works, the scope and scale of it. We listed many, many human rights standards, laws, regulations, policies from international level down to individual company level. And we then looked at the reality for tea workers and farmers as reported in a wide range of reports from the media, from academics, from government, from NGOs, from trade unions. And we identified a significant gap between the human rights in principle for the tea workers and farmers and the human rights in practice. And then this last year, we then did this root cause analysis of that gap between the human rights in principle and human rights in practice. And you asked about how difficult it was. It was actually, I mean, it was obviously a lot of work because we interviewed and did surveys and did focus groups of around 200 industry stakeholders. So it was a lot of work. But in terms of difficulty, people were very, very willing to speak to us. And that was very heartening. We probably went where it was easiest to go. We focused on South Asia and East Africa, partly because that's where we have the most contacts, but also because Thirst is based in the UK and a lot of the retailers and brands that we interact with are UK based, and they buy a lot of their tea from South Asia and East Asia, and East Africa. In this study, we haven't looked very closely at East Asia and Southeast Asia. That's something that we're hopefully will do in another study later on. We were very pleased at how willing people were to speak to us. We also visited a lot of tea estates and tea farms and met with workers and farmers and government officials, managers, owners of companies, a whole spectrum. And it was absolutely fascinating to learn both the sort of differences in different locations and at different levels, but also to see the patterns, to see what was common across many of those perspectives that we gathered.
These two broad regions are also where the plantation model has been in play for the longest time, isn't it? So I think just sheer numbers, I imagine, coming out of these regions is huge, and therefore the need for understanding what human rights looks like here.
That's true, yes. Yeah. And in both regions, there's also, either a growing or well-established smallholder farmer sector as well. So it was very interesting to see the differences between those.
When you posed a question about human rights, what sort of responses did you hear from the various stakeholders?
So I think there's quite a wide variety of responses to that. There are, many within the tea industry who are very aware of the human rights issues, of the low pay, the, substandard housing, healthcare, education. We know, of course, that many of these things are provided by plantations, but they struggle to be able to afford to provide them to an adequate standard in many cases. But I think because we were looking at the whole value chain and not just, in a sense, blaming the producer, that made it easier for them to have those conversations. You know, when we made it clear that we're not saying, as many earlier reports have done, you know, this is terrible, you should do something about it. We are also asking them, you know, what would make it easier for you to provide these adequate services? What impact is it having on your commercial viability, the fact that you have to pay for all these additional services that maybe other industries don't have to pay with? You know, how is the downward pressure on prices impacting on your ability to do that? So people were happy to talk about that. There was some pockets of denial that there is any problem. There are some in the industry who, you know, probably have been in the industry for generations. They've maybe taken on a company or an estate from their father. And as we were discussing earlier, it is often from father to son. It's very rarely that women own these estates and companies. And they have, you know, a very deeply rooted connection with those companies and with those estates and feel that they are doing the right thing. They've done it this way all their lives. Their whole life is rooted in this way of working. And so when someone comes in and says, you know, that the human rights are being breached, it's very personal for them. And they don't see that there's anything wrong with it. The very common argument that we hear is, well, you know, of course, well, there's two very common arguments you hear. One is you can't expect them, tea workers on plantations, to have the same standards of living as a middle class person in the UK. One interviewee actually phrased it as you can't expect them to have the same human rights. I mean, to be fair to him, I don't think he meant that. I think he meant the same standards. But there is this kind of attitude, and that was one of the root causes that we identified, an attitude towards tea workers that they are, you know, they're somehow less deserving of comfort, of security. Another was that compared to people living outside the estate, they're better off. So they would compare them to people working on construction sites or quarries, you know, industries which don't provide housing and healthcare and all the other benefits, which, you know, obviously it sounds amazing when you think that when you describe it like that. Whereas, you know, what Thirst and many NGOs and people who work in the human rights world are saying is that you shouldn't be comparing any worker with another worker who's worse off. That's not the benchmark. The benchmark is the internationally agreed human rights, is the national regulation for what standard those benefits should reach. So I think a lot of people see the term human rights in a different way. They see it as a lot of people in tea producing countries, I think, see it as a Western kind of concept being imposed on them, and it's an extension of colonialism. We have to remember that human rights are internationally agreed, and that many countries, many of the tea producing countries, have ratified the International Labour Organization conventions that protect those rights. These are not something imposed from outside. They are a human right, and they're the rights of all human beings, wherever they live and whatever industry they work in.
When you speak to people who work on the estates, the workers and the pluckers, what's their view and their attitude? Is there a better sense or awareness of human rights, or do they share some of the same views that management shares, because it's also something they have inherited?
A lot of people who I've spoken to who work on tea estates are not very happy because although, yes, they have lived like that for generations, I think nowadays people are much more aware of what they could be earning, or what, you know, what life they could be having. They have access now to television, to the internet, and maybe also just generally, you know, awareness of rights has increased. So workers, to some extent, I think, are mindful that, you know, they should have better pay, that their children should have better education. I mean, I don't think I've ever met a tea worker who isn't struggling to raise more money to educate their children. They are all desperate to get them educated and get them out of the tea sector, which is something that the sector really needs to address and think about how they're going to run the estates or grow tea in the future. I have to say, we didn't interview a lot of tea workers or farmers for this study, because our original study, the literature review, covered many, many reports in which hundreds, if not thousands, of workers were interviewed. Because in this study, we were looking at the root causes, which tea workers and farmers themselves may not be aware of. We were looking at the whole industry and how it functions. So that there's a very small number of workers that we actually interviewed for this study. But obviously, you know, Thirst never misses an opportunity to talk to tea workers and farmers when we can. They are aware of the impacts of these things, but they're not so aware of the root causes behind it. But occasionally you would get glimmers. So in some tea factory workers that I interviewed in Tanzania showed that they did understand that there was, you know, an issue about the price that is received for the tea, and that's why it's hard for them to receive a better wage. I've spoken with a tea worker in India who, when I asked why do you think it's mostly women who are plucking tea, who are employed to pluck tea, and she said, because we are easier to boss. You know, so there is a kind of some sort of understanding of you know, why they are in the situation they are. But as I said, they're very keen to get their children out of it.
You've listed 9 root causes in the report. And I think bookending the entire study is the first one on pricing. The other end, you have resistance to change. One was very specific, very tangible. The other is rather intangible. So between the two, it seems like the whole spectrum of what's affecting the industry is all there. I wanted to understand how you've organized the report and what readers should keep in mind when we read it.
Yeah, that's a really astute observation, actually, about one being tangible and one being intangible. I think that's right. The first one that you mentioned, price, actually, the first one is a little bit more complicated than that. We've called it Economics 101 because, it is about the price, but it's about the fact that prices are low because there is this massive global oversupply of tea, combined with a stagnation in demand. So, you know, high supply, low demand, obviously the price is going to be low. And yet governments still keep increasing the output of their tea. And yet there are organizations which still encourage farmers to increase their yield, increase their production. And, you know, that until that stops, the price is not going to improve. It really is urgently needed for tea growing countries, companies, organizations to face the fact that there is too much tea now, and they've got to find a way of finding a balance between the amount of tea that's produced and the amount of demand that there is for it. So that was the first one, as you said. The last one, actually, the resistance to change was the 10th one. We had 9 root causes and then this resistance to change kind of underlying it all. And that is a really interesting one. We proposed this idea of organizational imprinting. It was originally found in animal behavioral studies, where when an animal is born, a bird is hatched, they will imprint on the first living thing they see and assume that's their mother. Those studies were then expanded to see how human beings react in that way as well, very often. And then that was extended to organizations, to companies and to organizations. So we have looked at the characteristics of the tea industry and the extent to which it demonstrates indications of organizational imprinting. And there are many points at which, you know, it meets the criteria. So because it was created during the colonial era. And when I talk about the tea industry, I should clarify that, as I said, we're focusing on very much on this trade between South Asia, East Africa and Europe and the West. We were very aware that that's not the whole tea industry, that there is also huge tea industry in China, in other East Asian countries, and also other huge markets for tea, for example, the Middle East and Russia. But we're looking very specifically at a large part of the tea industry, and one which is rooted in this colonial past. And because it was created at that time, many of the systems and behaviours and attitudes and processes have been preserved very much intact from that time. And so, as well as the, you know, the kind of tangible, to use your word, things like the way that tea is traded, like the way that plantations are organized, the hierarchies, even down to, you know, the siren that goes off at 6 o'clock in the morning to get people up and going to the tea fields, all the way to the attitude that managers have sometimes shown towards workers, you know, in some cases, talking about them as if they are less than human. And, you know, how do you respect somebody's human rights if you don't see them as human? So, yes, those were two very important bookends. But I would say that the other root causes that we identified, they are all interconnected. So, you know, the colonial past is connected with the attitudes, which was one of the root causes. One of them was entrenched trading practices. That's obviously connected to colonialism, but it also affects the price. And so, you know, they are all interconnected. I wouldn't want to just pick one out and say we should work on this. It has to be looked at as a whole.
When you look at the multiple stakeholders, how big is the divide between the various groups, whether management and worker, men and women, small farmer, big estate? Do you see a big divide within the industry, or is there a little more cohesion that's sort of coming in? Because that too was one of the problems listed as a root cause, isn't it?
Yes, the fragmentation of the industry at every level, and this was what was interesting about the study, was that each of these root causes, we're not seeing them just at one level of the tea value chain, but throughout the value chain. So, for example, the sort of unequal power dynamics was one of the root causes. So you see it between women and men in plantations. You see it between the different hierarchies in a plantation. You see it between tea producers and the buyers, or tea producers and the brokers that broker the relationship between them and the buyers. You see it between the powerful supermarkets and the tea companies that they buy from. So, you know, all along the value chain is the same root cause playing over and over. And that we saw, again, you know, in the fragmentation as well. The tea industry is becoming more fragmented, I would say, because, you know, originally there was this plantation model, and as I said, a lot of it still remains intact. But there's, you know, a very rapidly growing smallholder farmer sector. Obviously, it's huge in Kenya, where there are, you know, over 600,000 smallholder farms who are part of the Kenya Tea Development Agency. But in other countries, there are also a growing number of smallholder farmers. I was very struck personally by the difference between workers on tea plantations, how they lived, how they were treated, how they felt about themselves, and smallholder farmers. When I was speaking to Dan about this a few months ago, I was mentioned this, that you have a plantation which has labor regulations in place. In countries like India, there's the Plantation Labor Act. And yet, because of the way that plantations are historically structured, because of because the houses were built in the colonial era, and often are still the same structures as before, there's, you know, a risk that those workers actually are very much more subservient to the management. Their houses are smaller, are less, you know, well decorated, they're in less good repair. And the smallholder farmers, even though, you know, none of them were rich by any means, the ones that I met, and I'm this is very anecdotal, a proper, you know, study would need to be done of it, but they appeared to me to have more resources available. Their houses were better, in better condition. They were often, you know, supplementing their tea with other crops, so they had crop diversity, which is also better for the environment. And but above all, they had self-respect, they had dignity, even down to, you know, a small detail like when you visited a worker on a tea plantation, often the person showing you around would just walk into the house without knocking, whereas the tea farmers were treated with much more respect, and that came through very strongly.
Thank you so much for this chat, Shobita. As always, it was insightful and enlightening, and we hope it will open those windows into possibilities. Wishing you all the best for phase 3, and we look forward to catching up with you once phase 3 is done.
Me too, Arvinda. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Produced by Autovita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.